Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Dr. Rex Cowdery, Executive Director of the Maryland Healthcare Commission. Also joining us in our studios from IBM is Tom Romeo. Rex, we've danced a little bit around this subject of incentives and how they help shape behavior. Could you talk a bit more about the role of incentives in our healthcare system?
Sure. One of the challenges that we have, I think, in designing a healthcare system is the nature of the market. And the fact is that the current way that we pay with third-party payers is sort of a strange economics because nobody sees the price of what they purchase. Maybe they see it in that deductible. And of course, you see it in that very strange explanation of benefits that you get where like the left-hand column is $182, but the negotiated price somehow magically is only $81, of which you're responsible for 15. But more importantly, the issue is when you're choosing healthcare, basically everyone's incentive is to claim as much of that common benefit as possible. There's no deterrent to that. So the question is, how do you introduce incentives into this system in a way that's fair, in a way that doesn't dramatically disadvantage or cut off from care people who are lower income, people who need chronic care medication? These new designs, the consumer-directed high-deductible plans, are excellent in many ways. They give people the negotiated lower price, the $80 instead of the $180 from the provider, but they make people fully aware of that negotiated price because up until you reach your $1,200 or your $2,000 deductible or your $2,400, you're paying that full negotiated price. So people tend to ask more questions about healthcare. Do I really need this MRI? Is it worth investing that money now? So people behave differently when it's, in a sense, their money on the line. Some of these new strategies like health savings account or healthcare reimbursement accounts do somewhat the same thing. They create an account. It's just for healthcare. In the case of health savings accounts, both the employer and the employee can contribute to it, but it is like spending your own money because you're spending it from this dedicated healthcare account. That does influence decisions. It influences decisions in that people buy less unnecessary care, but unfortunately, there's evidence that particularly with people with lower incomes, it also deters necessary care. People are more likely to stop medication that they should be taking for hypertension. So that's our challenge, is how do you encourage physicians and patients to choose value, to not immediately go to the high-priced spread when something else is equally as good and a third as expensive? How do you encourage that choice of value without deterring necessary care? So I think we've got the next decade is, I think, going to be focused on that, whatever direction we move in healthcare financing. How do you encourage doctors and patients to deliver high value?
Sounds a little bit like an economist's nightmare with all those externalities that you described.
Exactly. Externalities is exactly what it is.
It's my understanding that in effort to address the problem of the rising number of uninsured, several states have looked at a substantive health care reform. And in fact, in 2006, Massachusetts passed a very heavily watched universal health care law that combines both private and public sector reforms. Has the commission explored this option, and what are some of the principles that the commission has outlined that would inform legislative options on universal health care reform within the state of Maryland?
We actually took the Massachusetts plan and looked at it in the context of Maryland. How would it work in Maryland? Because we have different insurance markets. Our small group market, for example, is quite different. They had two crises that drove their reform. One is their individual market was a disaster. Very high premium prices, very little appeal, and very sick people in were the only people insured through that, basically. So they had a serious crisis in terms of the way their health insurance market was functioning. And if they didn't do something to reform and broaden the coverage in the state, they would lose a bundle of federal funds. We face a slightly different set of problems. It's not as urgent, but we thought it was important to look at if we provided individuals, no matter what company they were in, with a broad range of choices, of plans, and if we subsidized low-income individuals. It's a combination of structuring the market in a way that people have choice and at the same time providing subsidies Now it would be based on the individual's family income rather than on, as we did with the small business, basing it on the wages. It's very important to have choice. It's very important to have a pool that has, frankly, everybody in it. One of the challenges of insurance is you got to get the healthy people into the pool to make it affordable for everybody. That's the purpose of insurance. You want everybody in the market. So the other part of it was individual responsibility, the principle that you should have health insurance. It's part of your social responsibility to be covered so that you don't become a burden on your fellow citizens. So individual responsibility is crucial. In order to do that, you got to make the coverage affordable. Subsidies are part of that answer. The answer is it's very expensive to do that, sort of in the range of $1.6 billion a year for the state. So clearly, we're more likely to see state experiments. We're more likely to see a gradualism, I think, an incremental change rather than a large change until something is guided either at the federal level or the federal government says, we're going to provide states with the funding that's necessary to conduct experiments.
Rex, you started to talk a few minutes ago about the importance of health information technology. So if we could go back to that, maybe you could explain a little bit about what is health information technology and health information exchange, and then give us a little bit of explanation about how the use of those two might benefit the healthcare consumer and public health in general.
Absolutely. I think we've all had the frustration of trying to get medical information or medical records. It's not an easy task. That's one frustration. But then for the providers who take care of us not to know right off the bat what medicine we're on if we appear unconscious in the emergency room, to know recent hospitalizations and diagnoses, to know where we've been seen and what our problems have been, because it shapes the kind of care that you deliver. So part of it is we know people make better decisions if the information is there to guide those decisions. How do you deliver that information to the time and place of care? And there are a variety of different models for that. So that's the health information exchange part. How do you get information that right now is in silos, sort of scattered about the region and maybe across the country, together to the time and place of care? The other part is having an electronic health record. That is, providers having an information system that both receives key pieces of data, puts it in, gathers data, can show you a graph of what's happened to your blood pressure over the last 3 years under different treatment regimens, for example, and shape how those decisions are made. The other part of it is decision support. We know from the IOM studies that we get the care that's recommended by experts in the field less than half the time. So part of the role of health information technology and electronic health records has to be to say, you know, this person has diabetes and hasn't had an eye exam in X period of time or a foot exam. It's due. And check here to schedule so that it comes right up at the time of a visit. It should make the provider's experience better because they don't miss things for one thing, but also because the reminder's right there. They can provide guideline concordant care easily and efficiently. So those two parts go hand in hand, encouraging electronic health records and encouraging safe and private and secure exchange of information.
To do their part, I guess, the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, is leading a 5-year electronic health record demonstration project. And Maryland was recently selected to participate. Could you tell us a little bit about what the demonstration is and what does Maryland hope to accomplish in that demonstration?
We know that the group that's going to be hardest to incentivize to take up electronic health records are small physician practices. Hospitals can do it. They can get efficiencies from it. They can actually, because they're paid on the basis of cases, they can actually make more efficient care and help pay for their information systems that way. Doctors don't have a way to do that currently. They're not being incentivized for it. So one of the things that CMS said was, well, suppose we actually develop a set of incentives. And suppose we do an experiment in different states where half of the docs will go business as usual, but we'll track them, and the other half of the docs will be paid. Initially, they'll be paid an amount that doesn't depend on using the electronic health record. And then in years 3, 4, and 5, they'll be paid based on achieving goals that are achieved through the use of these electronic records. So it's really a test of whether providing these incentives to small practices will drive the adoption of electronic health records and improve care. So it's an interesting design. We're actually the first state to get this. We are in the process of recruiting physician practices. We know they face a tough economic case because these are not cheap systems. So we hope that this will actually make a difference in adoption.
Two critical elements in the exchange of health information, especially electronically, within the states are privacy and security. Could you tell us a little bit about your efforts in that area and specifically about the assessment the Commission conducted on privacy and security policies and some of the key recommendations that came from that?
Absolutely. We've done actually a number of things. There was a task force on electronic health records. There's specifically the assessment on privacy and security. This comes from the recognition that all it would take is a few missteps to set this movement back dramatically. Health information is different. You can be made whole after financial information is disclosed or after, you know, money is diverted. If your health information is disclosed, there isn't. They're concerned about the impact on their employment, for example. So it's vital that it be safe and secure and that only authorized people get it. That's much easier said than done. So we have taken a very deliberate process to ask, what is enough security? If you end up in an emergency room, what's enough assurance that this request is valid, it comes from the right person, it comes from an authorized place, and they ought to have this basic set of information? What is in that basic set of information? And how do we transmit it in a way that we're sure of who it's going to, so that both the people sending it can be assured of that and you and I can be assured that it's only going appropriately? Right now, federal law, for all the complaints about HIPAA, federal law is very loose on this issue. It allows exchange of information for treatment. That's not a whole lot of restriction.
Now, the National Institute of Medicine estimates that as many as 44,000 to almost 100,000 people die every year in U.S. hospitals as a result of lapses in patient safety. To this end, could you tell us about Maryland's efforts around patient safety? How does the Commission monitor evolving patient safety issues and measure patient safety successes?
There are several parties here that are involved in this. The General Assembly stimulated the development of the Maryland Patient Safety Center, which has been extremely important as a testbed for safety processes. We competed that. We helped set it up. Our sister agency helps fund it. A lot of the funding comes from the hospitals themselves, who recognize that this is a substantial issue. So we have really a two-stage process. The first is places like the Maryland Patient Safety Center and hospitals that work out how this can be done, show that it can be done, demonstrate it, do it voluntarily, do it on a collaborative basis. And then we port that over to public reporting, where we will be reporting the incidents of ventilator-assisted pneumonias, but particularly the central line infections first and foremost, and a series of other safety issues. There's a parallel effort going on in our sister commission to look at sort of avoidable events. And, of course, the question is, how do you disincentivize hospitals? Right now, ironically, although hospitals don't do this intentionally, obviously, but hospitals are paid for mistakes. So the question is, CMS is working on trying to not pay for mistakes. And similarly, I think that effort will go on in Maryland, which has its own hospital regulatory and payment system that is unique and the only one in the nation. So we're pursuing some of our own questions about how to do that appropriately.
What does the future hold for the Maryland Healthcare Commission? We will ask Dr. Rex Cowdery, Executive Director of the Maryland Healthcare Commission, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.